Maxik died today, or maybe yesterday. I can't be sure. The Tumblr says Alexander Maxik passed away. Funeral tomorrow. Deep sympathy. And yet I saw Alexander Maxik tweeting this morning, which leaves the matter doubtful. It could have been yesterday. That is, assuming that Maxik is indeed dead. One should probably not trust what strangers have to say about the present mortal status of literary authors.
Okay, so I am here with Alexander Maxik, who is most recently the author of You Deserve Nothing, which makes me feel a little humble. But Alexander, I think you deserve something. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being here. I wanted to first of all start off by discussing the experiential requirements in writing a sort of anti-Parisian novel in Paris. You told Large Hearted Boy that you made it the point to avoid certain music while working on the novel. Now, I'm going to have to ask you, do you also have to avoid certain people or certain locales when you're writing this kind of novel? From an artistic position, isn't avoiding some of these kinds of normal or privileged aspects of Parisian life just as bad as the other side? How do you fashion a perspective, or several perspectives in this case, when you ignore certain aspects of Paris? And also, can't you mine something from the totality of experience? Just to sort of start here.
Yeah, I lived in one of the most, if not the most expensive neighborhoods in Paris. But I lived on the top floor of a building without an elevator, which allowed me to pay a lower rent.
It's been a wonder about other experiential qualities.
Well, we can talk about that. Yeah. We can talk about that. But when I first moved to Paris, I had this very sort of clear sense of the kind of Paris I wanted to experience, and very quickly, it was boring to me, and I started to explore, particularly the northern parts of the city, and found those parts of the city to be far more interesting, and spent more and more time there, and started to read actually at a bar in the north of Paris called Cabaret Populaire, and it was sort of there that I started to see the city as it really is, because when I first moved to the city, I was, it was all Hemingway and Boulevard Saint-Germain and all of that, and now I see the city in a far more different light.
Yeah, what bored you specifically about the neighborhood you had to escape from?
I mean, it is wonderful because it is a cliche, because it is, at least physically, exactly as the postcards make it. I mean, you know, the Luxembourg Gardens looks exactly as I imagined it would look, and the cafes remain, at least outwardly, Parisian, like a Robert Doisneau photograph. And now, Paris is often criticized now as a sort of museum city where there's nothing sort of behind those beautiful facades. I don't think that that's true. I just think it requires a little investigation.
Well, you could have perhaps knocked on a few doors and asked to sort of see the insides, introduce yourself. I mean, you know, this whole idea of like, oh, well, I'm bored, I have to go somewhere else, it intrigues me because a lot of novelists are determined to get at the wonder underneath the boredom, or to find something that's interesting.
Right.
Why couldn't you have found something that was interesting?
Well, I did. And it's, of course, it is simplistic to say that, you know, that everything in the sixth or the fifth or the seventh is one thing. I mean, I can't make that argument. But because there are so many tourists, because the city sort of uses the center of Paris as a sort of advertising campaign. It's very well preserved. It's very clean. All of the gold is polished, all of the doors are kept, in a certain fashion.
Yeah.
And the outskirts of the city, in large part, are sort of ignored by the city. By the government. I mean, things are dirtier, the river is less sort of elegant at the outskirts of the city.
Yeah.
So,
it's fascinating to have this conversation, and we're here in Midtown, right, which some might argue is the most boring aspect of Manhattan.
Yeah, I would tend to agree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what of this? Do you think that hitting the outside of the city is really the only way to understand it, both as a novelist and as a human being? Has this been the sort of pattern throughout your life?
Or? I mean, I don't think I have. I know that I have. There's never been a place in my life ever that has held so much appeal to me from afar. You know, I was never sort of caught up. New York, for example, you know, is the city for many people. But I was never really seduced from afar by New York.
Yeah.
Paris is very particular to me. And
what was it about it that seduced you?
All of the cliches.
Yeah.
All of the cliches. I read, you know, and I've said this before. In other interviews, but you know, Hemingway and Shakespeare and Company and Gertrude Stein and the whole deal, and I read A Movable Feast, you know, many times, and at a time when I was very impressionable, and I had these notions of wanting to be a writer, and I just thought somehow it got in my mind that Paris would be the answer to all of my questions, all of my problems. This is where I would be my truest self.
Yeah,
and I, you know, that's a recipe, I think.
Has this been the pattern throughout your life of essentially being seduced by a cliche and then pursuing the cliche and then finding out what's around it, that this is really the only way for you to find this identity here?
Or? Yeah, I mean, I think I have this tendency to imagine that a place will solve the problems of my life, that I will be another person in this place, wherever it is.
A topographical panacea.
Yes,
basically.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I love to make plans, and I love to travel, and I think part of that love is this sense that of reinvention, that I can be a different human being, you know, that I can kind of wipe the slate clean. And of course, you know, I, as I discovered, I think in a very concrete way in Paris, that is, you know, you are who you are wherever you go.
Let's get to the novel. Okay. I wanted to talk about the way that Will encourages his students to read Camus in the original. Yet the prose, especially Will's perspective, this is several perspectives, offers this read that is almost deliberately written as if it is English that is translated from French. How much of this feel was deliberate on your part? I'm wondering how much of You Deserve Nothing was thought about, felt about, even organically initiated in French. What of this?
It's true that I knew that I wanted to write in a very spare, reduced style. And I think it may be, you know, my sort of abilities in as a French speaker are pretty basic.
Yeah.
I mean, I can do it, but I there's certainly not a lot of elegance in the way that I speak French. And I did read some Camus in French, and I did translate from French into English to the extent that I could do that. And I think necessarily it was a very simple translation. But I didn't set out to give that impression, to have a sort of a feeling of a translated text.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as I said, there is a kind of simplicity and a kind of spare language that I appreciate, and I knew that I wanted it to be sort of unadorned as much as possible, particularly from Will's point of view.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because here you are broaching philosophy. Sometimes it's offered in this sort of schematic form, and perhaps this effort to get at it in the simplest possible manner, in the Camus-like possible manner, really made it account for this kind of takeaway I have of it representing something that almost doesn't seem like a voice. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's indicative of his state of mind. I mean, I really saw that character as someone who is really suffering from a sort of disassociation from a severe depression. I mean, for me, and the novel really is in large part about depression.
Yes.
And I think his voice, that sort of distance, I mean, I hope that the only descriptions that are elevated are those in which he's teaching.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, I was conscious of that, certainly.
On the other hand, uh-oh, if it is about depression, I want to actually point to some reviews here. A reviewer at The Rumpus suggested that Will's fall from grace is particularly devastating. Mm-hmm. But given that he declares at the end, somehow I feel ready to live my life again, I found this to be almost a weirdly liberating finale, even if he is deluding himself to some degree, because despite the fact that Marie identifies him as terrible looking, having the bags underneath his eyes, I felt that it was liberating, largely because he has to escape this institutional entrapment where he has administrators dictating what he can teach. Mm-hmm. Math teachers who are anointed as school counselors and the like. And I bring this up, and I also talked about this book to other people who read it, and some people thought it was a positive book and some people thought it was a negative book. So we're dealing with depression, we're dealing with a man who does the irresponsible, and yet there is this kind of liberation, and some people may be devastated, some people may not be. I have to ask, how many explicit subjective revelations did you shear from the text over the course of several drafts, and how did you account for so many variegated viewpoints? I mean, I'll get into author-reader later, but I was curious about from fashioning the perspective, mm-hmm. if you had scientifically or even organically came around with certain aspects like this.
I mean, there's no question that I toyed with making the, particularly the ending, more of a sort of neater and revelatory conclusion. I did that late, frankly, and I did it out of fear. I think
fear. What kind of fear?
Well, I was afraid of ending the novel with a character that I knew would be so, well, I think for some people, unsympathetic and sort of unapologetic. And it was Alice Siebold, actually, who said, no way. You know, you can't, this is not the book that you wrote.
Yeah.
And I really, I knew that I didn't want, I mean, it was above all, I did not want to write a novel that was in any way moralistic. But when it came down to the truth that it would be published, I got nervous. You know, I thought, you know, people will hate this. They'll hate that he is, you know, nothing has been changed or at least dramatically changed in his character. That he's just sort of wandering off. And I mean, I hesitate to reveal too much of the ending.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, that he is just essentially wandering off, or going off, I should say.
Yeah.
I think he has changed dramatically. And I see it as a positive novel. I don't see it as a happy novel, but I do see it as a positive novel.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the institution reflects, the institution of the school reflects his, you know, the sort of, his own sort of psyche in a way. I mean, he has just enough life at school to keep him alive, but it's a you know, ultimately a really kind of grim life.
Yeah.
And for him to get away from there, I think that's what's positive.
Yeah. This nervousness upon it being published.
Uh-huh.
Did you experience any nervousness during the course of writing it,
No.
Were you operating in some sort of buffer of just creating the thing?
Because I didn't believe it would be published, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I wanted it to be published,
of course.
You know, of course, but I wrote in with the sense that my, you know, finish the book. That was what I said to myself. I said, you know, finish the book. Don't worry about the writing at first. Just let it go. Just write 1,000 words a day. Write. And, you know, be as fearless as I can possibly be in the subject matter. And then I'll worry about it in the end. And, you know, it's sort of incredible to me that this is, in a sense, the end. I mean, now I have to worry about it, you know, because it's out in the world.
Well, that question is especially interesting in light of the fact that we are talking about existentialism
about
what it is to be judged by others and to inhabit the world.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you didn't have that feeling as a writer when you were actually approaching a particular subject. Was it a sort of blinkered push forward into the unknown
I felt like I was writing in a vacuum. No one's watching me write.
Yeah.
No one's reading what I'm writing except for a few friends.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't feel like there's really all that much to risk. And that's the strange thing I found about writing fiction is that you write in a sort of vacuum. There's no one looking over your shoulder. And then if you're fortunate, people start to read the book or the story. And then suddenly, years after having written it, you know, you have to sort of revisit who you are as a person when you're writing the work, and it's a very strange experience.
Yeah. You mentioned Alice Siebold offering some conceptual ideas or conceptual edits.
Yeah.
I'm curious how much of a line editor she is and how much she just totally raked you over the coals. I have to
I mean, she there was a, you know, there was an edit on every page for sure, which I really wasn't anticipating. I received this package, you know, the sort of marked up manuscript, and I thought, my God, she's actually edited this thing. But it was so subtle, and you know, it was, as I've mentioned before, all about sound and, you know, getting rid of certain tics that I had, repeated images, words that I sort of seemed to lean on.
More on the language side than the emotional side?
Mostly language,
So she was trying to get you to avoid elegant variations, repetitive phrases, things like that.
Yes.
At one point, Maya says to Will, "They love you, you're changing lives, you're a life changer." Will then shakes his head, and then Maya says, "They love you. Mm-hmm. You're a cult leader."
Yeah.
There's a suggestion here that Will might be a little bit of both, and that his failure to see these gradients in between is one of the reasons why he's in this particular spot. Despite the patch that he's teaching his class, that there's a grid over an apparent incoherence in life, he isn't necessarily able to see the way that his own teachings may be directionless and that his own viewpoint may be directionless.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, you know, if there was any point that in which you tried to tackle the Will character where he was more aware and more intuitive of his, you know, directionless, possibly disastrous advice to various students, because that seems to be one of the reasons why he gets involved with the affair.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it was important to me. I mean, the fact is that he is self-involved, arrogant, self-indulgent, inconsiderate, and he's an egomaniac, I think, and probably in a sort of clinical sense.
Yeah.
But I wanted to write that character. I wanted this to be a story about someone who was so self-involved, and I think a lot of his sort of his pain is justified or is understandable. But I wanted to write that character, particularly because I wanted to put him up against his students, who for me are the bravest characters in the novel. I mean, Gilad for me is the hero of the book. He has a maturity and a sort of curiosity that Will simply doesn't have. And Will is a kind of dead character and is a model, maybe an anti-model for his students, but they don't understand that until sort of midway through the book.
Yeah.
And that was important for me. I did not want him to be heroic in any real sense.
Yes. On the other hand, you do have someone like Colin, the Irish kid, who does some extraordinarily monstrous things.
Yes.
And that also allows us to sympathize more with Will by introducing that particular one step beyond. We're able to sympathize with these, you know, not as monstrous or perceived as not as monstrous actions. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering why you almost felt the need to push the reader into this mode of sympathy like that.
I guess I don't see it as pushing the reader into a mode of sympathy so much as sort of challenging the readers. I like that you hate Colin.
Yeah.
And then you can't help but like him.
Yeah.
And it was important to me not to cast judgment. You know, I feel very strongly that, you know, people are 50 things in the course of a day, and that, you know, who you are in the morning is not who you are in the evening. And I think that's particularly true when you're, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old.
Yeah. Did Colin allow you to find new points for the characters to inhabit more than just your typical protagonist, antagonist, side character, and that kind of thing? Did he serve that kind of role for you as from a character balance standpoint? Or?
I mean, the truth is that he's one of those characters that I didn't know what I would do with him.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, I was worried that he was just a sort of device.
Yeah.
And I think I got out of that, or I tried to get out of that, by providing him depth and complexity. And so as a result, I mean, that was when I didn't know what to do, I would try to make my characters a little bit more human.
Yeah.
And as a result, I hope that the book took on, or takes on, you know, sort of more complexity in general.
There's an interesting under-the-hood philosophical debate to be had here, because if these characters are no longer devices because you have made them more human, then you have a shuffleboard game here where you're not sure exactly where you're shooting for.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a very uneasy place to sort of work in the dark like that. I mean, did you have a blueprint in mind, or were you trusting that things would work out with all these characters just constantly oscillating in terms of points of morality like that?
I don't work with any kind of outline, with any sense of outside, and I, you know, I made this comment the other day, and somebody said, well, that this is a kind of outline, because I said, you know, my outline is always time.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of a school year, because it's a very sort of clearly defined temporal sort of schedule.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I'm not pretending to be some sort of genius or magician, but I just trust that the story will unfold out of character, and that's the only way I know how to write. So I didn't really know where I was going, except that the school year would end, that breaks would happen, that people would come back from breaks. And that's how I sort of measured time.
Time and location really were the confines with which to fashion.
Yes, time, character, and place. Those are the only things that I feel like I have control over.
Got it. There are a few moments in the book where we see a situation unfold from two perspectives. But unlike other books that deal with unreliable narration, the odd thing here is that a lot of the details tend to match up. And that is really interesting to me. What steps did you take to sort of establish this? I mean, kind of, we were talking about confines before, but what steps did you take to establish this lining up of events like this instead of, well, I saw this and he saw this kind of approach? It's very interesting in light of the fact that you are talking about students and teachers who are trying to divagate their way towards some sort of concrete aspect of how we live, and yet you almost don't want to give them any of this perceptive card that they can play. They can actually this out like this.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this come about? I'm curious.
Well, I don't see that all of the events line up.
Yeah,
I think that, you know, for example, Marie's version of events is often, I wouldn't say markedly different, but certainly different than Will's.
Yeah.
While the same sort of physical actions take place, the sort of perspective on those actions is obviously are quite different. I didn't want to make that device of the unreliable narrator a way to play too deeply into this sort of moral ambiguity element of the novel. I mean, I was worried about that in particular. But I mean, I guess I'm not sure if I'm answering your question exactly.
In other words, you wanted their reaction to these events to be the barometer,
yes,
or the shifting barometer, rather than a hard interpretation of
precisely
an existing. Okay.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah.
The way in which you describe affection in this book is quite interesting to me, because it's very directional, as opposed to two people who are mutually experiencing something. I think of Will washing the dishes, and then his hands are seeped into the water, and then you have Maya, another teacher, behind him, grabbing onto him.
Yeah.
Even the layout of Will's apartment, which we've established is actually close to your own, involves being at the very top of the stairwell,
uh-huh,
having no further place to go. I'm wondering how much of the sex and the affection grew out of this directional approach. How much of it came out of this sort of teacher-student power dynamic? And, you know, late in the book, you do have Will confess that he wants his students to love him back in return.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that all forms of love, whether through learning or whether through illicit affection or whether through genuine love,
mm-hmm,
genuine is a subjective thing, but it seems to me that it's all about following a direction rather than two directions, kind of two arrows colliding into one here. So I'm curious about this. How did a lot of this develop?
I certainly don't see the sort of the teacher-student dynamic as a perfect parallel between,
yeah,
you know, in terms of the relationship that Will has with Marie. But I think that his sort of flaw is that, or one of his flaws, is that he can't help but deal with everyone in his life as a kind of instructor, because it allows him distance.
Yeah.
And I think it is as the closest he comes to any real intimacy is when he is in the classroom, and there's a moment when he wants to sort of remove himself and just sit there and watch the students interact.
Yeah.
And to me, that is the closest to genuine love that we get in the novel, at least from his point of view, because he feels something there. He is not an actor. He is not sort of driving the action of a given moment. Otherwise, he can't help but sort of tend to people, and in doing so, and provide advice, and keep control, instruct, and to you know, prepare meals, and all of these things that he does. It is absolutely a sort of effort to be in power.
Yeah.
So
that this might actually be why it's directional, because Will can only see the situation from a power dynamic. He has to be in control.
And I don't even know that I don't think he's self-aware enough to know that this is the case.
Yeah.
I think we as readers, you know, make the observation and we see it almost immediately. And I think finally, so do his students. You know, that this is the extent to which he is capable of you know, intimacy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Going back to this, it's interesting that with Will and Maya, the teacher-teacher relationship is very close to the teacher-student dynamic.
Right.
Other people believe that they are a couple,
right,
which is a very interesting situation, and they have been together for so long, spending a lot of social time outside of work and the like. Are they trapped more by professional duty or what you were talking about just here, or is it more of a situation where Will, who is quite drunk on existentialism, is incapable, as you say, of understanding affection outside of sort of these fixed views of humanity?
Yeah, I mean, I think she, if she had her way, would have, you know, they would enter into a real relationship, and I think they probably should.
Yes,
but Will, she poses too much of a risk. I mean, she is a woman, and she, you know, she's intelligent in ways that you know, a 17, 18 year old woman/girl cannot be.
Yeah.
So I think his heart is with her.
Yeah.
But he can't do it.
Yeah.
He cannot do it. And again, I think that, you know, she's a relatively minor character, but I feel like part of the sort of tragic nature of Will's character is that he's incapable of, you know, he is being presented with a real opportunity for something, you know, for a significant love, and he can't do it.
Yeah, yeah. But and he's also fashioning these students into adults that are beyond their present age.
Yeah.
Or you know, it's an interesting moral argument, because you could argue that in some cases, yes, they actually are just as equipped as any adults to deal with certain aspects of existence, and in other cases they are not.
Sure.
So, so to some degree, you could say that Will is exploiting these kids. On another hand, you could say that he is empowering them.
Yeah.
So, did you intend for all moral questions to sort of have this kind of open-ended, going back to the subjective thing that we were talking about here?
Yes.
Is that more of the sort of thing?
Yes. I mean, I guess I don't really see what he does in the classroom as negative.
Yeah.
I really don't. I mean, I see his talent there. That is sort of where he's best.
Got it.
And I think he's good at it. And I think, you know, challenging kids in the way that he challenges those kids, I think it's positive. I see that, and I intended it to be a positive thing, perhaps provocative.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, he's not asking them to, you know, to take heroin and, you know, jump off bridges. I mean, he's just asking them to, you know, to ask themselves questions and to be engaged. Outside of the classroom, I think is a totally separate story.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But it is something of a game.
Yes. Oh, for sure.
Yes.
But I think teaching is something of a game.
Well, okay, that's interesting, because I mentioned that because I have to ask you, in light of the fact that Greek vacations play very much into this book, and there's a lot of philosophy, I was thinking, oh, well, maybe he was inspired in part by John Fowle's The Magus.
No, that's funny. I thought you were gonna say The Secret History.
Oh, no.
No, although, you know, it's been a very long time since I read that book, but I really liked it when I read it,
yeah.
And it was, you know, a long time ago. But no, it was not inspired at all by that book.
Okay. I have to ask about Abdul. For all of Will's apparent enlightenment and even the way the students look up to him,
yeah,
he does kick Abdul out of the classroom. And there's also this notion of Gilad feeling as if he is betraying Will. So I'm curious about the Abdul character and how he entered as sort of similar to Colin, mm-hmm. as a way to really spell out that, well, Will is not what he is.
Yeah. I mean, I worried about him being, about Will being perfect anywhere. Even in the classroom, I didn't want him to be perfect. I wanted there to be evident cracks in his, even at his, when he's at his best. I think, you know, where he fails in the classroom is that he can be a bit of a bully.
Yeah.
And that he is sort of so charismatic that it sort of overwhelms the classroom, and it becomes a stage rather than a classroom at times. You know, as far as Abdul goes, I mean, it's, I don't know. I'm not sure. I think that character provides some real challenges for him, and would any teacher.
Yeah.
And I want something that was important to me when I was writing the book is that the classroom scenes be true to the experience of teaching, that there are, you know, these students who are difficult in various ways, and I hope that he is, you know, one of those characters.
Got it. Near the end of the book, one of Will's students, Hala, says, "You may not claim to be an example, but you are nonetheless. You are anyway. You don't get to decide how people see you. And you know, right, that you are an example to a lot of the students at this school, Mr. Silver. I'm sorry, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you don't get to choose." Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about this because it seems to me that the senior seminar, which is voluntary,
yeah.
is kind of similar to, hey, the reader who is reading your book and coming up with all sorts of theories and takeaways, and you, Alexander, don't get to choose. Do you feel that you in this novel are as much of an example as Will is? I mean, that even though you are dictating the terms in which you write this book, you cannot dictate the terms in which people actually perceive it. What enlightenment does your reader walk away from this book?
Oh, I couldn't answer that question.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope that it feels like being in that classroom, and that was certainly intentional. I mean, I wanted the reader to feel that you know she was participating in this seminar, but I certainly wouldn't you know say that this is what I want a reader to take away or from the book.
Yeah,
no.
But you were saying that you were nervous earlier about publication.
Yeah,
so how do you deal with being an example?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that I'm. Yeah. I mean, certainly don't think that I'm an example.
Yeah, there may be very much an Abdul who is going to probably come show up to one of your events. Maybe I don't know.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, you know, who knows? It's funny because I have had very few conversations with people who've actually read it. I mean, the book only came out, you know, a week ago.
Yeah.
So you are, I think, maybe the first person I've talked to. No, that's not true. I had one other interview with someone who's actually read the book. So I'm not really sure what the response is going to be.
Yeah.
You know. And you know the reviews have been few so far, and
yeah.
So we'll see. But you know, beyond saying that I don't feel any real sense of. I mean, I don't know. It's an interesting question. How are we responsible as fiction writers? I don't know. I mean, I was as honest as I could be, and I hope that the characters are alive. And I hope that I've told a compelling story and a story that provokes questions. But beyond that, I don't know what other responsibilities I have.
Well, Alexander, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Thanks.